the creator and producer of about a dozen game shows, including The Dating Game, The Newlywed Game, and The Gong Show. Barris became a national TV celebrity as the manic host of The Gong Show, a talent show of novelty acts and performers who were astoundingly bad at what they did. Many viewers loved The Gong Show for its flamboyant and ironic disregard of taste. Others condemned it for what they perceived as its condescension to performers and viewers. Barris started his television career in the early 60s, working for ABC Television. One of his first assignments was to keep an eye on American Bandstand during the payola scandals. While on that assignment, he wrote Palisades Park, which was recorded by Freddie Cannon and became a big hit. From 1963 to 65, Barris was ABC's director of daytime programming. When he left that position, he developed his first game show, The Dating Game, which ABC bought after an initial rejection. Barris hasn't had any game shows on TV in the past few years, but he's written a new semi-autobiographical novel titled Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. It's written in the form of a memoir with a main character named Chuck Barris, who is a successful game show producer, but is also a hitman for the CIA. Barris says he did, in fact, once apply for a position with the CIA, which he'd turned down to accept a position at ABC Television. Confessions of a Dangerous Mind has just been published by the St. Martin's Press. And by the way, Chuck Barris grew up in the Philadelphia area. Welcome back to Philadelphia, and welcome to Fresh Air. Your novel's semi-autobiographical, and you say you almost joined the CIA. Why did you want to combine the real-life you with the fictional CIA you?
Well, excuse me. The combination was perfect for what I wanted to write. I've been dying to write this book that would be funny and tell an opportunity to tell a lot about what happened to me in Hollywood and New York and television, but also develop a character who was both crucified for entertaining critically lambasted for entertaining or attempting to entertain the public, where on the other hand he was given presidential citations and medals for killing enemies of the state. The CIA was a perfect, in sort of my Walter Mitty fantasy, this was a perfect matchup for this character, because basically I always thought the emphasis was way off in the seriousness of our shows and what we did, and perhaps this was a way of pointing it out.
Well, why did you apply for that job years ago with the CIA?
Well, I had been out of work for a long time. I had been in the networks. I had left, and I thought it was a big mistake to have left because I love television. And now I was out of work for 6 or 7 months, and I was getting kind of desperate. And I had the ability to rationalize anything, and I saw this advertisement in a Columbia University newspaper, and I went and I followed it up, and it was for the CIA or the USIA. I think they were looking for people for both. And I could make myself say this is going to be a great opportunity. I mean, I try to talk myself into the wonders of the CIA. It would be patriotic. It would be so forth and so on. But I really didn't expect to get in. And I got in all the way up to the FBI clearance, which surprised me. I went to Washington. I appeared in front of the panel. I answered all the questions and so forth. And I was actually. That FBI check was apparently just a rubber stamp, because they weren't going to find anything dangerous about me. And just about when I had one foot literally in the CIA, I got a job offer at ABC, and I ran to ABC. The thought of that stayed with me for a long time. And being having a little imagination, I kept thinking, what if I had stayed and proceeded to do that? What a strange combination that would have been. And then the tenor of my game shows, I mean, The Dating Game, at one point we sent dates all over the world. You know, we were sending people to, quote, romantic, unquote, places, you know, Paris, London, Rome. But we sent them to Moscow, Romania, Belgrade. We sent them to Yugoslavia and so forth. And again, that thought just kept reappearing. What if the chaperone was a CIA courier? What if I went along as a courier? And then it fit in perfectly when I started to write Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, because I just wanted to set up that premise of, as I just mentioned, the guy who gets criticized so acutely for what he did to entertain and praised so covertly for a killer, and it worked. I mean, it worked for my own needs.
Well, you're most famous for the game shows that you've produced. Did you watch a lot of game shows before you started creating them yourself?
Well, actually, I worked at ABC Television when ABC as a network was just getting into game shows. They were just becoming competitive. So I actually learned in that era what they did wrong, what they didn't do wrong, and so forth. I never watched much of my competition because I really didn't want to be led by them. And I went off on another route. I went to people. My shows weren't question and answer shows or stunt shows. They were people, what I call people shows, spontaneous shows, things that would set up. There was no right or wrong answer. And we suffered or succeeded by that. The people in the shows would say funnier things than we could ever write. But they similarly could say things that we couldn't air. And we had to watch how we safeguard ourselves.
What was the state of the art when you started producing it? What were the shows that were popular then, the game shows?
Well, I think there was What's My Line, Price is Right, To Tell the Truth, Truth and Consequences, Beat the Clock, shows like that. And, of course, a lot of those shows were the genesis of shows to follow it, as mine, I think, had continued to procreate new shows, which, fall back on some basic formula.
Your first show was The Dating Game.
Right.
What was the premise as you initially conceived it?
It was a time of rock and roll heroes, the Beatles, the Dave Clark Five. And I try to think of a show in which three teenage girls would be separated by a wall from three kids, and one of them might be a rock star. And in some form or other, I was looking to match them up so that one of the girls would get the rock star and just faint from excitement. That never happened. But what did happen was one girl, three guys, or one guy, three girls, and any age. It could be any age. The premise evolved down to the identifiable situation of when a guy meets the girl for the first time. We've all been there, more or less. We've suffered through that, and that's what I was looking for.
How did you audition both the people who were doing the judging and then the contestants who were there to be chosen by the...
You mean in The Dating Game?
Yeah. How did you find them? And did you look for certain looks or a certain kind of personality?
Yes, we look for in The Dating Game.
In
The Dating Game, we look for extroverted, outspoken people. We always look for the girl was, generally it was a girl and three guys. We made exceptions. The guys, originally it was supposed to be a very handsome fella, a celebrity, a very handsome, what I would call civilian, a celebrity, and then the nerd, the guy who you would go, oh, she picks him, who was generally a very personable, with a great personality. And that was the ideal dating game, with a very pretty, innocent girl. It didn't always work that way, but to this day, if I were doing the dating game, that's who I'd look for.
Did the nerd usually get chosen?
Invariably, because he had the best personality,
And so when they went out on their date, was there a chaperone?
Yes. Well, originally we the dates went in and around Los Angeles, and there really wasn't a need for a chaperone because they were chauffeur driven, and a limousine in those days, that was pretty good. And the limousine driver more or less kept an eye on him. He worked for the company. He worked for Dating Game, Chuck Barris Productions. But then, the network came to me and said, I wrote about it in Confessions, that they wanted something for nighttime. There was an opportunity for The Dating Game to go on prime time if I could come up with something different, and I couldn't figure out what could be different. And it dawned on me through a bunch of things that sending those dates instead of in and around L.A., make them these romantic dates to places all over the world. And that's when we needed a chaperone. I mean, that's when I remember saying to the network executives, well, they said, we can't send couples that are unmarried off for a weekend or a week. And they were right. And I said, well, we'll send a chaperone. So the chaperones turned out to be my employees. Anybody who was 21 or over, again, I made the rule. When you were if you're 21 years old or more, you could chaperone a couple. And people who work for me, who worked at Chuck Barris Productions, kids, 21-year-olders, 22, 23, and all the way up, went everywhere. I mean, each week they were going off to Morocco, to Rio de Janeiro, to Hawaiian Islands, Tahiti, Moscow. It was incredible. And they got, at first, I had so much fun saying, Ralph, Paris. And he goes, oh, my, he jumped. And I'd say, Mary, Stockholm. But then after about, you know, we were on for 8 or 9 years. And in the second year, I'd say, Ralph, North Africa. And he'd say, what part? You know, they became so blasé about it, I got furious.
I'm thinking about how bad a blind date can be and then imagining what it's like in Stockholm trapped with somebody who you realize you're not very compatible with.
Well, that's scary. But what happened was that it became a threesome. It became a kind of a legal menage a trois in that the girl, the guy, and the chaperone sort of teamed up. The chaperone became one of the gang, and that's how it generally evolved. You know, if they didn't quite get along, no one had to stay with any one person. They could stay with the threesome, you know. And it worked out really well.
Did the chaperones end up falling in love with any of the women?
Yes, and vice versa. Because, you know, the kids that work for me were young and kind of great.
What were some of the double entendres that were typically used on that show? Did that happen a lot?
Well, it happened in the very beginning. You know, I always thought The Dating Game was the most innocent of shows. At least that's the way I visualized it, particularly being a Philadelphian. I had those great visions of innocence in my shows. When it went on the air, it was I don't know what happened, but there seemed to be an immediate novelty in saying dirty and lewd things on the air. Whether they were just getting their kicks that way or what, or they thought that their friends were going to see it, or they were you know, being wise guys and showing. I don't know what what they were proving, but that we had a rash. I couldn't use the first three shows we taped, and I was I thought I was doomed before I even started. And again, this is the thing I wrote about in Confessions. I mean, it goes into it in a little more detail, how I solved that problem, which I won't tell you. No, but seriously, I had to figure out some way to go into that and to tell those girls and guys that are playing the dating game, scare them into not being this way. And once I did it, and once I got over that hurdle, then we really didn't have much problems.
My guest is Chuck Barris, who has written a semi-autobiographical novel titled Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and it's just been published by the St. Martin Press. Well, your next really big hit was The Newlywed Game, as if, you know, after you date, then you're married and you could go on The Newlywed Game.
Well, I looked to the household, you know, for my show ideas, because my shows, as I said, were people. And I wanted highly identifiable shows where the audience could identify with what was going on. I thought that was critical to the success of a daytime show. And, of course, the next logical step was after dating was marriage. So the newlyweds came with a reputation, you know, built-in reputation. It was slightly sexy, and it was this, that, and the next thing. And it was naive, and it was this. It worked fine. That worked fine. And I think The Newlywed Game was, and it turned out to be the best show I ever created, and ever would, I guess. If I wanted to put something in a time capsule, I'd put The Newlywed Game in there because it's so simple and it works. It's just need four couples, eight questions, Bob Eubanks, and if it were 100 years from now, it would be Bob Eubanks' great-great-grandson, and you'd have the potential of a very funny half hour if the questions were good. And I think that's what's so wonderful about the show. It's so basic. I also think it evolved into a microcosm of marriage as we know it. I mean, I think if anybody really loved their partner and respected their partner, they would never do The Newlywed Game. You couldn't put your partner up to so much potential embarrassment. However, I don't believe that in the great wash of marriage that most people love and respect each other. I think they get married for any number of reasons. That's not, those two aren't some of them. It's, you know, it's time to be married. I'm at that age when I should be married. All the rest of us are married, or it's a thing to do. But it's rare when I believe, and maybe this is you know, extremely cynical, that people really marry because they're really truly in love with each other. So there was a Newlywed Game, and everybody was saying all those wonderful things. And I checked to see how divorce ran, and we had about a 40% divorce rate, and that's exactly how the country runs. So there was a Newlywed Game, as I say, a kind of a microcosm of marriage. But I think it has been, it still is, a very funny show.
What do you think the motives were of the couples who wanted to get on the show?
Just anybody else, just the motive of, I was going to say anybody else's motive, really, the basic motive of doing something like that, of being on television. You know, it's Andy Warhol's Every One of Us Will Be a Celebrity for 15 Minutes. It's true. Everybody has a chance to have fun to have their friends see them, to talk about it for about, you know, a day or so. That's basically all it is. Let's go down and do a newlywed game. And, I mean, they don't come down to win a washer or a dryer. They come down to be seen on television and see themselves. And I think it's a natural thing to do.
Did the typical couple end up squabbling before the show was over?
The typical couple generally got in some kind of a fight of sorts, but it was generally comical. It wasn't ever serious. I went on to develop a show that had a serious implications, and to my surprise, which in the chronology of it all, it comes down toward the end. A show called Three's a Crowd. But in the Newlywed Game, their fights were more fun than anything else. They didn't seem that way, I guess, at the time, but they really were. I would like to go back and show some of those, you know, outtakes, you know, some of those stuff in those days we couldn't show on the air, and have the couple come on that we could now because times have changed, and have a couple come on the air and today and look at them on the air 8 years ago. And I'd just love to ask them, how's it been over the 8 years? What's your marriage been like? How was it that night when you went home? I think it'd be interesting.
What are some of the things that you couldn't show 8 years ago that you could show now?
Well, there was a different nomenclature. We couldn't speak semantically. I believe that, our outtakes, as I said, we, you know, classified outtakes, obviously something you couldn't show on the air, are innocent today when you listen to them or see them. We couldn't say toilet. We couldn't say God. We couldn't say make love. We had to use whoopee for make love. You know, like, what was the funniest thing that happened to you and your wife while you made whoopee? Be that as it may, you know, it was so frustrating in a sense, this bureaucratic boundaries they were putting around us, when we could say it in some other form. And I'd always kind of push to the limits to see, you know, where we could go without the standards and practices people coming down on us. But as I say, if you would look at something today that 8 years ago was banned, you'd be surprised.
Do the network censors give you a lot of trouble?
Constantly. We didn't badger them as a, it just doesn't pay to, because you want to go in and do your work and not have to constantly be answering memos and so forth. But I couldn't resist ever pushing them just a little further. In what we could try to do, and still within good taste, hopefully, because that's what we really wanted to stay. We didn't want to be ridiculous about it. But those were the things they would talk about, and now, and looking back, as I say, it seemed rather innocent.
How were the people on the Newlywed Game prepped before the show?
We would look for, obviously, for extroverted, very up people, not shy, not reticent, and we prepped them in a sense that we played the game using, you know, standard questions, and they got the feel of the game. And we would then tell them to just be themselves and, you know, say what they feel and mainly the rules of the game, that you know, how to hold their cards and the technicalities that were involved. That's all the prepping there was. That's all the prepping we used to do on most of our shows. In all of our shows, we just would let them make sure they knew the rules. And we told them that obviously anything they would say and that would be in bad taste, we would have to not only bleep that portion out. We'd never see air, so why would they do it? And most likely we would replace them, which would have been difficult if we had to really do that. But it seemed to work.
What do you think appealed in that show to the listeners, the viewers?
The Newlywed Game?
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous identification and the spontaneity of it all. The awareness that these people were married less than a year, no matter what their age, and the fact that they might just say the silliest things. You know, we asked how many pints of blood would her husband say is in her body, and she'd start counting it off. She'd put a hand to her forehead, to her nose, and say one, from her nose to her chin and say two. You could never write that, and you'd have, and basically that was it.
Chuck Barris is my guest, the producer and creator of many TV game shows and now the author of the new semi-autobiographical novel, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Let's talk about some of the game shows that you tried that weren't as successful, one of which you just referred to, which is Three's a Crowd. What was the premise of that?
Well, there were two basically that weren't as successful very quickly, that I remember distinctly. One was How's Your Mother-in-Law? I went to the mother-in-law next from the Newlywed Game. I just, again, thought the mother-in-law was much like newlyweds and dating. It was an institution that we all had a preconceived notion about. The one thing I failed to take into consideration was that the mother-in-law is somebody's mother, and you cannot really poke fun or in any way, you know, make fun of somebody's mother. And that really was a blanket across the show, that feeling. It just didn't work. It was funny, but you were always making fun of somebody that you really shouldn't be making fun of. So the mother-in-law game was a quick, short disaster. There were a couple of more shows that worked, and then we came to Three's a Crowd, which was a show I always believed was one of the great dramas that I could translate into a game show, and that I was convinced it would be the best. It was the very obvious triangle: who knows the husband better, the wife or the secretary? Again, I was looking for humor. I was looking for spontaneity, saying lines that you would never, you could never write yourself. The preparation to the shows were fine. We ran through the questions. Everything seemed to work well. But something happened between the prep and the air. It became serious. It wasn't funny. I always prided myself in the fact that anybody that ever did my show had fun doing them. These people were not having fun. They were uneasy, ill at ease. Things were emerging from the show which were very unfunny and very embarrassing. And it came across through the screen like a rainstorm. I had that uneasy feeling, and I knew I was in deep trouble, that I'd created something that went against all those rules.
Well, how would you emotionally relate to somebody after a show who you felt was actually unnecessarily like embarrassed or humiliated or hurt as a result of the program?
I would be very, very upset. It didn't happen often. It happened rarely on all of our shows. I mean, what the critics said, which I always felt they were writing for each other, and what and how the people felt, I always felt were two different things. I thought the people always knew what we were trying to do, and the contestants or the acts or whatever were always having fun, no matter what happened. Mike Wallace challenged me on that once. He called me on a lady that fainted on a show called Treasure Hunt. She thought she had won a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or something. She ended up winning a Rolls Royce, and when she heard, she fainted. And Mike asked if I wasn't I orchestrating the emotions of these women for my own benefit? And I never could agree to that, because I know that lady was having a wonderful time. And so he checked her out, and he went to her house. He did it on 60 Minutes. But that was, and she did. She said there she was in her little, those little short pants, you call them beach something or other, in her little shirt that she wore on the program, and she said she had a great time. That was the way I always looked at things. When we ever hurt anybody, and we did that on Three's the Crowd, occasionally on a Gong Show, somebody would misjudge somebody and realize afterwards that they really were playing that seriously, and were hurt by their rejection. I would feel very badly, because that was never an intention, and it hurt me. And we took Three's a Crowd off the air.
Speaking of Chuck Barris, and he's the producer, creator of many game shows, and the author of the new semi-autobiographical novel, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. Let's talk about the Gong Show. Now, I know I used to watch Ted Mack's original Amateur Hour all the time when I was a kid, and I used to laugh all the time at the acts on there. And then when your show came on the air, it was a talent show. Were you supposed to laugh at the acts who were on there? How did you dream the Gong Show up?
I thought first that we needed an outlet for talent. There weren't any variety shows, and there weren't any nightclubs anymore where you could go to see singers and comics and magicians and so forth. And I thought there must be out there tons of them. There's just no outlet. And I thought that Gong, it wasn't called the Gong Show, whatever the name was, the talent show, would be the answer. I sold the premise to ABC, the television network, and then when I started auditioning, I realized there really weren't that many great acts, but there was an awful lot of bad acts out there. We went back and said we couldn't do the show, but then as an afterthought, I kept thinking, well, what if we reversed it? What if we did a parody on all these talent shows like Ted Mack and Major Bowes and what have you, and had more bad acts than good, and had this big gong and so forth, and that's how the show came to be.
And how did you become the host?
Well, that was an aberration. That was something that just was completely a fluke. The first host that we had when we mounted the Gong Show and went on the air, he had completely had the a wrong idea how that show should be. He thought it was an actual talent search. He felt there was this was serious. And what amazed me was that I could not get through to this man that this was not our point. The point of the show was humor, fun, parody. This was a camp talent show. Well, I knew the vehicle would work if we had the right guy hosting it. And since it was just a mechanical job at first, I replaced him only temporarily, just for a week or two, till we could find the right guy. And I was so bad and so inept that I fit right in. I just sort of blended it right into the acts. And as a creator, I could see that this was working. It was the act and me against the world, you know. And we had a great rapport. And also I had met that act through auditioning them and rehearsing them. So we did have, by the time we were on the air, a sort of a personal connection, and it worked. And I stayed on. I stayed on for 4 years, and I really never was a performer at heart. I you know, had to wear a hat with a brim down over my eyes so I wouldn't see the audience for a while and things like that.
So that's how you developed the hat,
yes,
as a signature?
Sure. It became a signature, but originally I was doing it in rehearsal. Once I wore a hat and I realized that I could block out the audience by the brim, and I could still read the cue cards. So I started to wear it on the air. After a while, I'm sure I could handle the audience, but not in the beginning. I was frightened.
Were all the acts on there in on the joke? Do you think that they all got,
yes,
that it was a parody?
They should have, and most of them did. I must say that I don't believe 100% did. I think there was always that small percentage that may have thought that they were going to get a break, that this was that they were really good when they weren't. We did have good acts on. We had to just to have the difference so that you could set up a difference. But I'm sure I'm talking about the people that weren't good and thought they might be. But we try to establish among all the people there that this was the Gong Show, and they should know that going in. We never try to fool anybody. I did on occasion. I remember I once talked a guy into doing the show who sold books out in California, who I knew at the time that I was misleading him. He was a terrible singer, and I wanted him on the show. And I kept telling him he was good. It really was. And when I had him on the show and he got gonged, he was hurt. And I realized what I had done and made sure I would never do that again.
Did you all decide beforehand who was going to get gonged?
No, it was never decided. We always said, you know, we give them. That's why we had to establish 45 seconds, because some people would be gonged without. And they were pretty funny, and we couldn't even get started, you know. And some acts were created so that if we let them go a little while, they were setting themselves up for something funny. And so we had to establish a 45-second wait at least. So everybody was guaranteed 45 seconds.
Did any of the acts on there actually go on to, you know, become famous or be on the Johnny Carson show?
Yeah, strangely enough, they have. Oh, since that wasn't the purpose, we never looked for a great number to do that. But from that show, a lot of people survived from the Gong Show. From you know, the money that they earned on the Gong Show, they could keep on, you know, developing their work. Pee Wee Herman came out of the Gong Show. Knights of the Ongo Boingo, the Brothers Karamazov. Cheryl Lynn, one of the singers. I'm not saying that the Gong Show launched them, but they worked on the show a long time, or a couple of times at least. Pee Wee came back a bunch of times.
What did he do on there?
Oh, he had different acts. You know, he came back as one of three people, and their acts were always good, always funny. It sustained him. That was one of the really great things about the Gong Show that were really never spoken of much, and that was how it kept a lot of people afloat for a long time, you know. And some of them will say that to this day, that, you know, it was the Gong Show that I could keep eating while I was working. And that it did in a lot of respects. We had a couple of the little Annies that went on to do Annie on Broadway. But, you know, as I said, that wasn't our purpose. So we had many, many more that obviously never did anything.
I remember two twins who dress in one set of,
yes,
overalls,
yes,
with play harmonica, and they went on to Fernwood Tonight.
Exactly.
know what kind of distinction that is.
Well, at least they went on.
That's right. They were a semi-regular on there. I think I saw them several times. My guest is Chuck Barris, if you're just joining us. I think it could have gotten really depressing after a while to see people who are, you know, incredibly untalented coming in dying for their spot on television.
Strangely enough, that was never the case. That never occurred to me as a possibility. If you could have seen it with your own eyes, we had one rehearsal hall that was just where all the acts stayed, you know, because we would tape five shows a day. And that was a Fellini-esque rehearsal hall. You could come in there, and there it would look like a mummer's parade combined with a Beaux-Arts ball. Acts were intermingling, singing together. Guys were juggling in a corner. People were doing their insane stuff. There was such a high in that rehearsal hall of excitement just generated by those people. And everybody came on that show with only one thing in mind, really, to get their little crack and have their fun. And there was never anything depressing about the Gong Show. It was such a high-energy thing. It was a subculture. Maybe that was one of the problems. It was so insulated that maybe we really didn't know the times were changing and that we should have modified ourselves if we wanted to stay on for a long time. But it was anything but depressing there.
How do you think the times changed to make it less popular?
Well, I believe they became more conservative. I think there was a swing. We went from Haight Ashbury and Free Love and everything all through the hippie period and through the 70s and then into the 80s, where I think there's definitely a strong conservative swing to less wild and woolly, carrying on more marriage, more dating, more back to the basics. I believe that's what's happening, or what's happened, and you just tone yourself down. Strangely enough, I think they're saying things you're allowed to say. I don't want to say what you're allowed to say, but you're allowed to say more than we could say then. But the overall feeling is one more of being a little more conservative.
Would you find it hard to operate on TV in a more conservative climate?
No, not at all. The swinging of the pendulum brings back places where you were before. I think the Dating Game would be good again today. The Newlywed Game would be good again today, because they're back into that time when we started, 15 years ago. And the shows that you create are back into that, into this new. You're always going to have that swinging, I believe, in the country's attitude, which then rolls over into show business, and you have to go with it. You have to be astute enough to try to figure out what it is, so you can create and keep showing your stuff.
People who didn't like the Gong Show said that it, you know, brought out the worst in everyone. People, you know, demeaned themselves on TV, and then even worse, viewers at home laughed wildly as they watched people make fools of themselves. Did criticisms like that bother you?
I never was really ever bothered by television critics, because I never felt that they ever affected the success or failure of our shows. I think in free television, commercial television, the people are the critics, and they'll tell you in numbers by your ratings whether they like what you're doing or not. I think when you pay money for something like a book, a play, or a motion picture, then you're tempted to read the critics and have them perhaps sway your thinking. But the people were the critics, and they seemed to be liking our show. So I only could look at the television critics and what they were saying about us as sort of an elite group writing for each other. That's basically the way I feel about them today. I'd love to be praised like any other human being, as opposed to be denigrated in any way. But I really couldn't pay too much attention to the TV criticism.
I think your next show after the Gong Show was the $1.98 Beauty Pageant.
That came about the same time. It was afterwards. It was. We did do that afterwards. I keep forgetting that I keep thinking of them in tandem. But we were on with the Gong, and then we came up with the $1.98, which was my answer to beauty shows, per se. We used to do a show called Dream Girl of 1969, I believe. We were on for 1 year on ABC Daytime. It was a serious beauty show. I mean, we had a weekly winner, and then we were going to put all the weekly winners together and get a yearly winner. And it was fine. It came to such a great build that when we started the second year, nobody cared. So that program went off the air. But in $1.98, I took that same concept and just, you know, we had three judges who never said a word. Nobody ever realized that we had three judges that never uttered a word in the course of the program. Celebrities. We had people who would come and sit and never say anything. We always picked the winner. We would pick the strange, you know, the sort of the most offbeat girl that we had up there. Sometimes we'd pick the pretty one. Sometimes we'd pick the unpretty one. We would sort of make that our own judgment. But that was, you know, the bathing suit part, the thing that the announcer always says while the girl's walking back and forth. If you ever listen to it, they were ridiculous. You know, it had nothing to do with the girl. But that's all that show was. I really think that the Darnetty show, 98, the $1.98 Beauty Show was a funny show. It went off the air when I quit television 4 years ago, and I just, you know, took everything off.
How do you think the $1.98 Beauty Pageant compares in levels of sexism as a parody to the real beauty pageants?
Well, you know, sexism was always the thing that followed me around in a way that I never really understood, in a sense that I never had those feelings personally about any kind of you know, my views toward women were always, I always thought were kind of great. I never felt that I was a sexist, but I kept being described as one. I just did the $1.98 Beauty Show only as a parody to Miss America. And all of that spate of beauty shows that we were seeing every other day, Miss Universe, Miss Teenager, Miss This, Miss That, and they just, those shows I thought were completely out of whack, and they were entertaining, but they had some kind of an accent that I thought was misplaced somewhere. So I wanted to do the $1.98 and have fun with that. That's all, that's what I just try to accomplish.
I think in 1980, Now presented you with the Grand Gobbler Award to the year's largest living turkey, citing you for consistently demeaning women and showing overall lack of good taste. What was your reaction when you got the award?
Well, I read that I got that award. Again, if they were serious, I would be hurt. Because in a sense, my own sensitivities would be hurt. I would be silly for me to say, I shrug that off as just another silly thing. If it's some kind of a ridiculous premise to the thing, then the heck with it. But I never believed, as I said just before, that I was doing anything with that connotation in mind. It never was my purpose. It was only to entertain, to not laugh at other people's expense. Just set up Olive and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, any kind of comic situation that has a beginning and a middle and an end, at the end you'll laugh. I can't, you know, answer to the other criticism that followed it. You know, we had criticism for the Dating Game as being sexist. I guess in a sense that's true in the true connotation of what people were talking about in that time when Three's a Crowd went on. I mean, there was an uprising. You know, women's groups picketed stations, surprised and set back a little bit by that reaction because it was totally unexpected. I kept thinking that they were just going to say these ridiculous things about their situation in the office. I could see where that kind of feeling was coming from, but it wasn't. That was not the intent. But these are strange times, you know.
I guess it's Chuck Barris, if you're just joining us. If you were a viewer, which of your own shows do you think you'd like the best?
Well, as I said earlier, I think I'd put Newlywed Game away in the time capsule for whatever contribution I made. The Gong Show is the most fun. And I also believe that we set some comic boundaries there that might have been the beginning of other things to come on television, and maybe had made some kind of contribution to comedy. I think The Real People and That's Incredibles, The Bloopers, and all those shows followed it. These people shows that just took the Gong Show and changed it and went. I'm not saying they copied it, but they took the category and just kept going with it. The Dating Game was fun. That was the first show. That was the paternal show. That was the baby. That got us all started. But the Newlywed Game, I believe, is the best formatted game show And if I were going to be remembered for game shows, that's a show I would like to best be, you know, remembered by.
One of the really interesting things about The Gong Show is it's one of the few shows I can think of on television that was intentionally ironic.
That's true.
Is it hard to do that on TV? I mean,
I think so.
Why?
Well,
why is it hard to be ironic?
Because I believe, and again, I don't know if I'm right or wrong by any stretch of the imagination. They're only my own thoughts, but I think that you have to go by so many boundaries in television. You're directed by what's been done before, what you think you can do now, what you think the needs are. That the irony starts to slip away. If you get on the air with something entirely different, something that's away from the rest of the crowd, and you have the executives at the networks or the stations who are willing to go with that, which is also hard to find, then you can set up irony in a sense that the show becomes an ironic television program. But that's a lot of facets that have to come together. I don't believe creators, by and large, think to be ironic. I think they just try to think to be mainstream if they can and get on with something that's in vogue, that's buyable, that's something they can create that the buyer will buy now because it's hot.
Yeah, is that how you think when you come up with the show? Like, what will they like or what would I want to do?
No, because I never... No, I'm not a television buff. I don't watch television. I don't do that as some intellectual snobbery or whatever, but I just find PBS... sports and documentaries basically what entertain me, and then I read a lot of books. But when I go into create television, I try to create something that's entertaining as only I know it. Now, what's going on is something else. I don't know really what is going on, and I'll go into the network and talk to the guys that know me and say, what do you think of this? And if they we have rapport on the same wavelength, I may sell a show. I think now I've been away from television for 4 years. I don't know everybody that's there. They've changed, and they have their own suppliers and their own people that they have rapport with. And I think it might be more difficult for me to come in with something now.
I've heard a lot of people who've done TV shows, after the show is over, they kind of repent and they say, well, it wasn't my idea of a perfect show, but, you know, after it went through all the network execs, it was changed. And, well, it's the only way you can really package it to get it on TV. Did you ever feel the need to... you know, repent you know, like take back anything that you'd done on television?
No, I never have felt any kind of remorse for what I created. I only feel sorry if I had to take back something. I never felt sorry for anything. If I had to, when I put on How's Your Mother-in-Law and How's Your, and Three's a Crowd, which were disasters, I didn't feel sorry about it. I just felt like, wow, I was way off base. I repent for making mistakes. I made some great mistakes, and when I look back on them, the Gong Show movie was a classic mistake for me. If I had adhered to the original concept of the Gong Show movie, which was a movie for the Gong Show fans, that might have been something, because we were doing sight gags before Airplane. Not that we would have been better than Airplane by a long shot, but that's the road we were taking. And somewhere along the way, I chickened out and took a right hook and tried to make a movie that said something. As what ended up was pleasing nobody. I didn't please anyone. I didn't please the Gong Show audience. They didn't like it, and I didn't please people who were looking for some kind of meaningful movie. And that hurt, because I was hoping to be successful in that motion picture so that I can go on and do something else that I would more like, be happier to do, that I would want to do more. But that mistake bothered me. And when we talk about being repenting, I'm sorry I couldn't see the stupidity in that mistake that I made creatively. But you can't dwell on that either forever.
You know, a lot of soap opera actors say that they really want to be doing Hamlet. Oh, I mean, did you have something that you really wanted to be doing? Do you really love game shows and the kind of shows that you do?
I loved game shows. I don't love them anymore, only in that I could not do game shows the rest of my life. That's the longest one thing I ever did. I love writing more than creating game shows. I wish I were a better writer. I'd like to write, Saul Bellow, Philip Roth type of book. Maybe someday I will. I'd love to do a play. I don't know if I'm capable of that, having a successful Glengarry Glen Ross, seeing your work come alive and people in the audience. When we did the Gong Show movie, it's the first time I ever came in touch with an audience that spent money to see something I created. And boy, that's a visceral type of thing. I mean, my body was doing all sorts of jumping around from wondering whether they liked it or not, because they had paid hard cash to see it. But I like to go out there and attempt some of those things, and you know, and keep working in that area than doing game shows that I've done before, and you know, and kind of have that down. I don't regret doing them. That was a great time, but I like to just go on and try a few other things and see if I can become successful.
Is the kind of spectacle that you can set up on a game show the type of thing that you think television does best?
I'm sorry?
Is the kind of spectacle, human spectacle, that you can create in game shows the kind of thing that you think television really does best?
Oh, I see. No, I think what television does best is nonfiction. I think documentary television, news, public affairs, and any kind of documentary is what they really do best. And I just think that they're getting, you know, as years have progressed, they're creating that so it's much, much more acceptable to the public as a form of entertainment. But that's where I think television shines. You know.
What have you learned about television viewing habits? There's a line in your novel where you suggest that people are always eating when they watch TV. Do you think that's really true?
I do. I think that basically people are eating. They're either watching it at breakfast before they go to work, they're watching it at dinner when they come home, or they're eating a late dinner, or they're going to television to get a snack. Obviously, that's not a hard, fast rule, but I always told my staff that if we could stop a fork, you know, if we could stop a spoon or a fork midway from the bowl to the mouth, then we had done something right. We had just created a moment that was okay, you know, and that was the slogan that we carried around the company: stop a fork, stop a fork. And whenever we would say, "Hey, that sure stopped a fork," we knew that we had done something that made you laugh a lot or stopped your fork somewhere or other.
You've said that you don't watch TV, but do you get to see Family Feud or Tic-Tac-Toe or any of the current game shows?
No. I say no. I don't sit down to watch those shows, but I think you can't help seeing them if you're going through the dials and turn, and you'll see them go by enough to get an idea of what they're doing. I can't understand those shows in a sense that I'd like to create or be a part of them. I sure love the success they garner, but that's a foreign show to me. That question and answer, wheels spinning around, lights blinking. I'm as foreign to that as perhaps you are. As you know, if you and I sat down in a room and looked at that, we both really wouldn't know what was going on. There are people who know that very well, and they do it very well. But that's not my type of show.
You have said that if there's a show that you could do, you'd really want to do a show called Greed. Do you want to explain how that would work?
I heard that as it was expressed to me not too long ago as a legend about a Chuck Barris joke. It wasn't a joke. It was I was trying to tell somebody what the critics or what the intellectual elite might consider the destiny of daytime television. That was a show called Greed, in which an old man, arthritic old man on crutches, would be standing there, and four contestants would be bidding down to see who would take the littlest amount of money to go out and kick the crutches out from that man. Now, you know, and then the next person out was a little boy and his dog. Well, you know, what would happen then? It was only my mouthing off as to what other people's concepts of what they thought daytime television might be trying to go to. And it was never in any way, shape, or form what I was trying to go to.
Did you find you became any more cynical about people or about television from your years producing television?
No, you know, strangely enough, I went through a real cynical time. I don't know why. Maybe I was overtired or working hard, or maybe I had the brakes weren't going the right way at some period or other. But in the last 3 or 4 years since I've been away from television, I can see where I was. I guess I mellowed in a sense of my view of television. They're not all that bad. There's always some guys in the networks and in the syndicated stations that can talk to you, and you can talk to them, and you can deal with them. I watch Grant Tinker trying to uplift television and then end up putting on the A-Team and figure, well, I don't think in my head that Grant Tinker, that'll show him. I just feel that he finally, you know, went to the realities of what he has to do. That's about it, and that's television.
Do you think television's going to stay the way it is? I mean, what would you like to see it become?
just more entertaining. I'm a television viewer. I mean, I do watch television. I like to go home and have some Brideshead Revisited, the plural of that on, more of those shows, more good Knicks basketball games. But what I think television is going to become is radio. I mean, I think that you're going to have 100 programs to choose from 10 years from now. You're going to have a box that looks like your radio set, and then you turn the dial, you go from 80 or 50 to 120, and it's going to be cable, network, independence, and the choice is going to be immense. It's not all going to be good, but you're going to have a choice.
You still get any royalty checks from Palisades Park?
Yes.
Who's recorded it lately?
No, it's only two people that I know have recorded, Freddie Cannon, who had the hit, and the Beach Boys. But I hear it on oldies all the time, and I still get a kick out of that. That was my first creative effort that ever was a commercial success, and it's a love for me.
What kind of music are you listening to now?
I'm eclectic in most things. You know, I can listen to classical music. I never know what's playing because I never know the title of it, but I recognize it and go to country and go to the only thing I really don't listen to is hard rock because I can't understand what they're saying.
Are people ever surprised that you're, like an educated man and all that? Reads
yes.
Novels, having seen like The Gong Show and The Newlywed Show, do they have certain preconceptions of what you're going to be like?
Sure. Not only do people have preconceptions, but critics do. It seems a lot of the press has preconceptions. And the funny part is they'll come in and talk to me and leave. And I thought, well, now that he must think now I'm a little different than he thought. And then I'll read, there it is. Just another, caveman review of some sort, but I guess it comes with the territory, As long as your friends and family think you're pretty nice, I guess that's all that really counts.
We're about out of time. Do you think you'll be doing any more TV shows?
Yeah. Yeah, so I have a show called Barris's Wacky World of Television for September of 1985. If we all are around by then, it might be on the air.
What will it be?
It'll be funny.
Are you at liberty to describe it yet?
I'm afraid to because it's a year away and I'll see it on in 4 other versions before I get there.
Got it. Okay. Well, listen, thanks so much for talking with us. It's really been fun.
It's been fun for me.
Chuck Barris has been my guest, the creator of many game shows, including The Newlywed Game, The Dating Game, and The Gong Show. He's written a semi-autobiographical novel just published by the St. Martin's Press. It's called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. That's Confessions of a Dangerous Mind by Chuck Barris. And he's, by the way, from Philadelphia. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.